transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
How you doing? And welcome to the show. This week I'm speaking with wine and food expert Tommy Powers. He's got lots of wonderful information on how to choose wine if you've been invited to a dinner party or you're just hanging out with friends. Our pop culture expert Eve Thomas drops in to discuss vintage clothes shopping and how this can really help you save on your wardrobe budget. And I've got a very special announcement coming up at the end of the show that could win you a very cool prize. Lots to do. Let's rock.
Capture your need for sound.
There are so many options, not to mention so many questions when it comes to wine and the art of pairing wine with your food. To help us navigate the sometimes overwhelming world of wine is food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy, Tommy Powers. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tommy, first of all, how did you get into the field of gourmet food and wine? Because it sounds like quite the exciting career path.
I really started when I was about 16 years old. My older brother was just starting to collect wines, and his sagely advice was that girls like wine, so you should learn about it. And at 16, that was all I needed to know. But I quickly found that it was exactly where I wanted to live, and so I've really dedicated my entire adult life to food and wine.
Now, I think a lot of people, Tommy, are intimidated, you know, when it comes to the world of wine. We feel like it's above our comfort zone, maybe difficult for us to sort of pick the wrong wine. We're scared of picking the wrong wine if we're going to a dinner party or an event. What do you tell someone who's going to an event and who has no real clue about which type of wine to bring?
You know, the one thing that I recommend for everyone is to find a good store near you. And today, with the growth of the interest in wine in the United States, the level of education all over the country is tremendous. And I think that's really the best way to start to buy more effectively. But, you know, even if it is that last minute thing where you're taking a wine over to a party at a friend's house, to go in and let them know, you know, this is my friend, this is, you know, how many people, this is what they tend to like. And the people in the stores can do a wonderful job of recommending wines for them. I can tell you at every price point, and I mean that literally from $6 up, there are wines that are of very good quality now. So it really enables somebody to spend the amount of money that they're most comfortable with.
Actually, that was a question that I had. I think a lot of us feel that like a really good wine needs to be something expensive, but you're telling us that you can find something that's really good between $15 and $20, no problem.
And even less. I mean, there's great wines today coming out of Spain, Chile, Argentina for under $10. But, you know, at $15 to $20, there's thousands of wines that are delightful.
And, you know, what types of wines would you recommend if you were going to, you know, a specific party where, you know, let's say it's going to be a steak or it's going to be fish? Like, it depends, I suppose, on the meal for sure.
Sure. You know, I think because of the movie Sideways, we've seen an explosion in people's interest in Pinot Noir. And I would say that Pinot is probably one of the two or three varietals that drinks best young. So much of the wine that we find in stores is current released. It's not been aged. And so a softer red wine, like a Pinot Noir, would work beautifully and can really go with fish. It's not ideal for steak, but it could work and certainly has. You know, I always recommend people bring sparkling wine to a party or a friend's home. And whether that's actually from the region of Champagne or a cava from Spain or even a domestic sparkler, you know, I think sparkling wines are something that always positively change the mood of the room. And it's something that we're just not drinking enough as a culture.
Joining us on the show today is food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy, Tommy Powers. Make sure you check him out at www.gastrotommy.com. Tom, I'm not sure, you know, you're joining us right now from Chicago. I'm in Montreal. I know that here in Montreal, we actually have the option of either going to what we call it the SAQ or the Liquor Commission or getting some of our wines at a grocery store. Do you recommend either or it doesn't really matter? Does it matter if you get your wine at the grocery store?
Now, you know, I think there's, because of the considerable growing interest in wine, there are good wines available everywhere. You know, I think a lot of what we see in grocery stores tend to be larger production wines. They are wines that typically have larger budgets. And so I think you really have to know a little bit about what you're doing there. But I think you can always find value. I think what's better is if you can find an actual wine store, you know, where this is what they specialize in, and there you'll find, you know, typically they are owned and managed by people who are very passionate, very knowledgeable, and I would say that you could find a better quality wine at the same price point than you could at the grocery store.
And, you know, for the true novice out there, and even someone who, you know, might, you know, go out to dinner with their friends and they sort of drink whatever the table's having, in your opinion, what really is, you know, the big difference between the red and the white wines? And, you know, can you maybe give an example of what a red wine would go well with and what a white wine would go well with?
Certainly. White wines tend to show more things like stone fruits, and think of white fruits, even certain citrus fruits. So apple qualities and a little bit of lemon, perhaps. We can see apricots. We can see mango. So tropical fruits as well. The alcohol levels are about the same. The other primary difference is that there's a process in which the wines are made, and red wines all go through what's called malolactic fermentation. And basically, that means it softens the wine a little bit, whereas white wines may or may not go through that process. So I find acidity in very good wines, particularly when they're white, tends to be a little bit racier, a little bit more pronounced. And red wines will find what are called tannins. And tannins are literally just the fibrous elements from the skins of the grapes, in most cases, sometimes a little bit from the stems. And God willing, never from the seeds, because they're very, very bitter. But these components create a tea-like effect, a sort of a grip, if you will, in the palate. Red wines love to go with big red proteins, but we can even see them done with fish, particularly when the accompaniment to the dish is a little bit darker. It's a little bit, if it's a char to it, you know, so we can see things like Pinot Noir, which we talked about before, or Barberas or Nebbiolos from Italy, or Tempranillos from Spain go beautifully with fish. White wines I love to see with, you know, white proteins, and certainly the wide array of seafood, and even some vegetables as well.
Is it true, Tommy, that, you know, white wine is drier, or is that just depending on the brand or the type?
It really depends on the type. So the relative dryness of wine in many cases is a function of acidity. And then there's a pH level to the wine as well, but that's getting a little technical. But I think we could say safely that it is not predicated upon whether that wine is white or red.
Okay. And then, you know, you were mentioning earlier with regards to price points and you know, various countries around the world where good wine is coming out of. In your opinion, in the next, like, couple of years, where do you really see good wine coming from? What countries should people be on the lookout for?
You know, I think Spain is an area that is producing an extraordinary amount of very good, high-quality wines at low price points, and I think the global economy is catching on to that. You know, Italy is also another country which, from north to south, east to west, is one basically continuous vineyard. And while many Italian wines were very poorly made for years, there is a remarkable amount of very high-quality wines coming out of Italy, also at very good price points. I think Spain continues to lead the world's options, but it's in the lesser-known regions, particularly in the south of France, where we're finding good values today. And then Chile and Argentina would be countries that I think are really taking off. You know, they've been making very good wines for some time, and they continue to make only more and more wines, mainly because most of the northern hemisphere's currencies are 2, 3, 4 times to one of the currencies in those countries. So it really provides, on an economic level, some very good values for us.
And what's your thoughts on Australian wine? Because for some reason in my life in the last couple of weeks, it just seems that Australian wine keeps popping up. Is that something that's sort of new and exciting?
You know, Australia is a country that I think was really hot 20 years ago and even 10 years ago. But because of the profound success they were having in the Asian markets and also in the United States, there were an inordinate amount of people who came in and started planting almost irresponsibly with no thought of, you know, what will the markets allow? How many grapes can we really produce successfully and sell? And what we saw over a period of time was that the markets in the United States changed, the market in England changed, and unfortunately the overall quality did not stay where it was, but unfortunately has dropped a little bit. So there is a wealth of grapes in Australia that they can't sell. And it's very sad because there's some really beautiful production there, even beyond, you know, that gross amount of production that increased.
And how are we doing in North America?
You know, I think it's probably the most exciting area, and I was remiss in not including, you know, what we're seeing in Canada, particularly in the Niagara Peninsula, but also, you know, in the United States. We're starting to see more and more wines coming out of Mexico, even in the Baja area, or even the part of Mexico. So I think the North American market is booming. There are more and more bright people coming to the playing field, and there's a wonderful sharing of ideas and technologies, and I think we'll see more emerging markets as we go forward. I think the thing that's most important is that as our palates have evolved and we're now starting to drink more balanced wines and not some of those hugely extracted, overblown, high alcohol, high oak wines, but we're seeing wines that have a little bit more restraint, a little bit more elegance, and are just better balanced.
Joining us on the line today is Tommy Powers from Chicago, and he's a food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy. Please make sure you check him out at www.gastrotommy.com. Now, Tommy, sometimes I think people get stuck in a rut when it comes to the wine that they drink. You know, they found a brand that they like and they seem to stick with it. How do you get out of that and actually experiment again? Or is it people that are just scared of trying new things?
Well, you know, there's lots of options available to us. You know, I think the best way for anyone, and, you know, reading what the critics have to say is helpful. But that's only one palate, and it may not be the same as yours. So the best thing that people can do are find these tasting events that are all over North America now, and oftentimes at very, very good values. And that's a great opportunity for someone to go in and try 30, 50 wines in an afternoon. And what I'm always amazed at is how much people are surprised, you know, where they think, boy, I didn't think I liked Italian wines, or I didn't think I liked Spanish wines. And, you know, to say that an entire country doesn't produce anything you like would be, you know, inaccurate. So the other thing I can say is that in a lot of the good restaurants and wine bars, you can often just ask for a taste of something. And so I would say, you know, try varietals that are comparable. You know, go into that store and say, you know, I've been drinking Sauvignon Blanc, what else should I try? Or is there Sauvignon Blanc from a different part of the world that I might be interested in? But, you know, mix it up, change it up. There are thousands of grape varietals out there, tens of thousands of producers, and you know, it's unfortunate that people just drink the same thing all the time. You know, as I say, we're supposed to be monogamous in one part of our life, but certainly when it comes to food and wine, we have the opportunity to explore and should do that and feel great about it.
And, you know, you mentioned just a few moments ago about the wine tasting. If someone does find themselves in wine tasting country or in vineyard mm-hmm. country, do you suggest they actually, you know, take the time and go on a wine tour?
I always like going in on my own rather than part of a group. I think sometimes you can get a little bit more personal attention. You know, these places are commonly staffed by people who are very passionate, very knowledgeable, and it's a wonderful opportunity to hone your skills and, you know, to have somebody work with you a little bit. So, you know, popping in tastings room, sometimes you may have to call and schedule an appointment, but that's not hard to do, and it can be really delightful. So I think it's great to do the big bus tours. Never really been a big fan of those. The one thing where they are very successful is that you will not be drinking and driving. And I think that's very important. So you want to sort of manage, you know, how many places you're going to go and what can you responsibly do.
Tommy, what do you say to people? Because I think, you know, the pervasive attitude, and I'm hoping it's changed in the last, you know, 10 years or so, but I think a lot of people feel just intimidated in the grand scheme of things, you know, with the art of wine, and that they're scared, you know, they don't want to pretend to be something that they're not, or elitist or pretentious. Right. What do you tell people, you know, who just really need to dip their toe in?
You know, there's several very good books out which do a great job of providing some basic education. I'm actually starting an educational series on my website for just this reason, you know, to really take people from the very beginning, assuming nothing, and over the next few years, we'll really drill it down. I've spent, you know, 15 to 20 years doing this, and it's something that I really enjoy. But, you know, for people who want to get a book maybe today, right away, Kevin Zarali has a book that's Z-R-A-L-Y called The Windows on the World Complete Wine Course, and that is the best beginning book that I know of. You know, I think that's a great place to start, but the other thing is to simply go out and to start tasting wine and start reading about it. And the main thing is to remember this should be fun. So the intimidation that we feel, I think, is unfortunate, but largely due to some of the unfortunate people that were representing the world of wine for some time, that, you know, were a little bit mean, a little bit cruel, would use their knowledge in an effort to make people feel uncomfortable. And I'm proud to say that most of those people, fortunately, have been run out of the business today. This is an area that many of us go to relax, to enjoy, to share with friends, to provide a little bit of levity, or maybe to add some beauty to our lives. And so wine should always be fun. You know, this isn't right and wrong. It's not surgery. It's really just food and wine, and we should just keep it at that level and have some fun with it.
And just to leave, you know, our listeners with an upbeat frame of mind, and again, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that don't have a clue about it, myself included. What would you say, you know, is there a wine, you know, just or a few brands right off the top that you would give us to say, you know what, you're safe going to a dinner party with these?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's a gentleman named Jim Clendenin, was really the first guy that I interviewed on my show, who has a winery in Santa Barbara named Aubin Clément. Jim makes extraordinary Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. His business partner, so they share a winemaking facility, is a gentleman named Bob Lindquist, who makes Rhone varietals, so Syrahs, Grenache. He does Viognier, Marsan, Rosan, and a little bit of Chardonnay as well, and the two of them are outstanding. There's a new hot young guy, Matt Licklider, has been in the business for years, who has a winery called Lioco that are just beautiful wines up in Sonoma. And I think, you know, we could even say let's add a family like Martinelli, who has been in the business for a very long time, extraordinary farmers, and they're making great Zinfandels and Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays.
Awesome. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
That's food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy, Tommy Powers. Make sure to check him out, www.gastrotommy.com.
Red wine, you make me feel so fine. You keep me rocking all of the time. Red, red wine, you make me feel so grand. I feel $1 million when you're just in my hand. Red, red wine, you make me feel so sad. Anytime I see you go, it make me feel bad. Red, red wine, you make me feel so fine. Monkey packing is the band of sweet red wine. Red, red wine, you give me woolly pazing. Woolly pazing, make me do my own thing. Red, red wine, you really know how to love. You're kind of loving like a blessing from above. Red, red wine, I love you right from the start. Right from the start, with all of my heart. Red, red wine in a 80s style. Red, red wine in a modern beat style. Till I die, and that's no lie. Red, red wine can't get you off my mind. Wherever you may be, I'll surely find. I'll surely find. Make no fuss, just
the warmer weather in certain parts of the world, it is time for a much-needed spring cleaning. And I'm not talking about washing the floors and windows and airing out the house. I'm talking about digging through your clothes and taking care of business. To give us some new ways of looking at this sometimes daunting task is our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, who is also a writer, an editor, and who just started a new blog called thegreatergoods.org. Eve, thanks for hanging out on the show today.
No problem. I'm glad to be here.
So, Eve, you know, you have a lot of knowledge when it comes to clothes because you used to work in the vintage clothing industry. So to get us sort of, I guess, in the right frame of mind, because I think a lot of us hate having to clean out our closets. Can you tell us, you know, how we should be looking at this task because, you know, of going through the old clothes? Because I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Right. I think everyone sort of has their own method of doing it. For some people, they say, you know, if you haven't worn something in 6 months, just get rid of it. But if you live in Canada or somewhere else with a cold climate, obviously that does not apply. So I think now is the perfect time to do it because you're bringing out all the stuff you put away, all your spring and summer stuff. So you basically have had 6 or more months away from it. So now you can look at it and be like, will I wear this again? You know, see stuff that you forgot you owned, wonder why you bought it in the first place. It's really a good time to sort of reflect on your wardrobe.
And, you know, I've heard this term, but I think some people haven't, and maybe some people don't even know really what it means, and I think I didn't until you explained it to me. What does shopping from your closet mean? It kind of sounds fun.
Right. Well, you know, it's a really nice, fun term for something that maybe doesn't sound so glamorous. It's basically going into your closet, into the back of your closet, into the depths of your closet or anywhere else you keep clothes, and looking at what you have, a real inventory, and, you know, rediscovering pieces that you totally forgot you owned. Obviously, you need to have a pretty substantial wardrobe to rediscover clothes, but I think everyone sort of has a few pieces they lost track of, and you just have that, oh yeah, I forgot I have this moment, and, you know, it's basically like shopping. It's a new piece of clothing if you've never worn it before or don't wear it a lot.
And I'm sure that you could probably, if you do find, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces that you haven't really worn in a while, chances are you may have some other clothing that would now match very well with that.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, who knows, you may have actually bought another, let's say, dress like the one you just found because, you know, that's the style you like. And, you know, now you realize, oops, now I do.
You know, and I guess another question in regards to all of this is, you know, how do you sort of go about refreshing your wardrobe without going into debt? Because, you know, fashions change. I think your style somewhat stays the same, but I think a lot of us always have this eye to, you know, clothing and how we keep ourselves looking new and exciting.
Right. Well, especially for women, because, you know, trends change and things like that. Or if you've lost a lot of weight or gained a lot of weight, it's not just a few pieces here and there. You basically have to replenish your entire wardrobe. So I have a few thoughts on that. I mean, one is getting rid of the stuff. So once you can actually figure out what you want to part with, you know, gather it all together. And my main tips would be either, you know, donating it and thrifting or doing a clothing swap, which is a really good idea.
What is that? It sounds scary.
Well, I mean, it sounds a bit like a swap meet or, you know, you bring clothes and someone gives you their clothes, but it's a little bit more complicated and more fun than that. I mean, as the name suggests, the purpose is you get rid of clothes you don't want and then you get clothes that you do want. It's really definitely the principle that one person's trash is another person's treasure in action. There are basically two main kinds of swaps. One is the large-scale swap, and this is the one that sounds a little bit scary, a little bit overwhelming. There's a group, actually, a nonprofit group called SWAP, and they hold events called Take Off Your Clothes. They do this across Canada, and they do it in the United States, and they even do it, I think, in the UK, maybe a few other international countries using volunteers. They're a really good group because they don't just, you know, it's not just a fun way to shop or whatever. They really emphasize like the eco-friendly aspects of this. Basically, I mean, every item that you swap is an item that, you know, you don't have to buy brand new. And also, they actually, anything that doesn't get swapped, they always donate it to a women's shelter or donate it to a thrift store, which is, you know, everybody wins. So I went to one last year, my first giant swap, and it was at the Just for Laughs Museum in Montreal. And this year it's actually in July at Place des Arts, which is quite a big place. I think it's going to be a pretty huge event. How it worked was you bought a ticket, like basically an entrance ticket, and I think it was somewhere around $10. And then you can either, they'll come pick up your clothes, or you can bring your clothes on the day, and they'll give you a ticket, like Monopoly money, for each item of clothing that you want to donate. And so then you get these tickets to spend, and it's all one for one. So, you know, you can drop off some sunglasses and you can end up with a dress in exchange. It's a little bit chaotic. There's a lot of people, but for the most part, everyone was really polite. And obviously, there are rules about what you can donate. You know, they don't want anyone ending up with stuff with tears or stains or pilling on a sweater, or, you know, no underwear or bathing suits, things like that. So, you know, there's a DJ. It's kind of like a party vibe. And there's also a special room. If you spend a little bit more and you donate designer items, you can get designer items back. Like, I basically donated 5 designer brand items, and I got back things that would have cost me in the hundreds of dollars in a store. So I came out on top.
And a question for you. I know you said you get this like Monopoly type money for the swapping, but for each item of clothing. So let's say, you know, I showed up with a pair of jeans, a shirt, like a jacket or whatever. Do I get 3 different types of you know, Monopoly type money, or is it all the same?
It's all the same. And okay. I mean, you know, there are, you can think, oh, well, this is worth more than that. But I think just for simplicity's sake, it's all the same. You can even get shoes and boots. So it's, you know, they're not looking at who gets more because, as I said, one person's trash is another's treasure. So you can say this pair of running shoes cost a lot more money than that dress, but if you like it and if it looks good on you, then you've already come out on top.
Okay. I'm glad you've explained that, because I wasn't sure if there was this whole like monetary type system happening.
No.
When you were over there. So you said it's like a big party. It's a bit chaotic, but I suppose if you go in with a focus, you'll be okay.
That's it. It's funny because I was talking to someone about it and she was like, I thought people would be, you know, mingling more and talking, but she's like, everyone I saw just had this focused look in their eyes and everyone just went straight to the racks and set up a bit like a shop. Went straight to the racks, straight to the boxes, knew what they wanted, and everyone was on a mission. You know, they're not there to make friends.
Wow, that's awesome. I think that's actually a pretty cool idea. Joining us on the show is our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, who started a very cool new blog. You have to check it out, called thegreatergoods.org. Now, can you explain this second type of swap? Should I be nervous?
Sure. No, this is the one that probably people have more chance that they've been involved with this, even if they didn't call it a swap. Maybe it was just a clothing exchange. It's the small scale swap with your friends or, you know, your coworkers, probably no more than 10 people. And the good thing about this is obviously they're people you know, you've met before, and you can kind of bet more that you share the same style, or you'll know which of your friends shares your style or even shares your shoe size or your dress size. And they usually include maybe dinner, some drinks. I definitely remember a few with cocktails.
To get a little loose.
Yeah, it gets a little loose. It's a little bit more laid back. You know, you're not, if you get something, it's nice. If you don't, then you just, you know, end up donating a bunch of clothes, or you get to see your friends get your clothes. And you
does it ever get, though, a little contentious? Like if you know, let's say there's, you know, five or six of you at this thing and then two of you want the same item, like how does that get resolved?
Yes, definitely. Especially among friends more so, I think. People bring out their stuff at the beginning and you get your eye on something. Well, the benefit of a smaller group is you could, I guess, make a deal with someone. You know, if they have something you want and you have something they want, you can exchange it directly. Or I went to one where they made the rule at the beginning of the night that if two or more people wanted something, they would ask a Trivial Pursuit question. And whoever got it first would get dibs on the item. So if you do make that a rule, brush up on your use of trivia before you go.
I think that's a good idea, though. That just takes care of any sort of awkwardness that could, you know, arise and contentious, maybe catfighting. So
you do not want to leave that angry. I think everyone should just have a good time.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Now, another question that I had for you is where do thrift stores come in? Because you were mentioning that earlier. Is that an option for your wardrobe? And, you know, I think some people still view that as a stigma. Is that still the case? And do you just get through it? Do you get over it? Do you move past it?
Yeah. I mean, vintage, thrift, it's always been a bit on the borderline. I think it's gaining acceptance, especially in North America. But there's definitely still people who think, oh, that's used clothing. Somebody's worn that. You know, I don't want to touch it. But, I mean, it's a great idea. For one, like I said, most swaps, anything that doesn't swap, they're going to send to a thrift store. Two, it's environmentally friendly. This is stuff, especially the older stuff, where I feel like it was just better made. So if it stood up for 20 years, it's going to last a lot longer, unlike a lot of the kind of throwaway clothing that's made today. I'm actually the youngest child in my family, so I never had a stigma against getting used clothing. I thought it was like the best thing ever. You know, jeans are already worn in. It's amazing. One thing I would say that I was joking to a friend the other day is that instead of saying something secondhand or instead of saying you got it at a thrift store, just say it's vintage.
Because nice.
Vintage has a lot less stigma. You know, models wear vintage. Vintage is in Vogue magazine.
That's
you know,
cool.
Just they don't need to know how old it is or where you actually got it.
And do you have tips, you know, Eve, for the vintage, you know, clothing, you know, because is there tips that you need to have when you go into these places?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, especially the larger places, if you just kind of go in blind, you'll just lose your way, or you'll, you know, be confused or bored, or you need a strategy before you go in. I mean, one, just figure out what you want. If you're going for a certain color or a certain era, just sort of have something in the back of your mind. One thing I do is I have a little shop near me that benefits a women's shelter. And instead of going in for like an hour and combing the entire place, I'll just stop in for a few minutes, a few times a week or a few times a month. And because they get new stuff in every single day and they constantly just put it on the shelves. So I can figure out straight away, like, oh, what's new? And I'll just kind of do a little scan for little housewares I like and occasionally some furniture. Definitely when you're looking at the clothing, check. You can do really, really basic checks. You know, you check the size and then just check the underarms, because sometimes if it's really old, there might be some staining and that's usually quite permanent.
Right.
And check the seams for things like stains and tears. And then when you get it home, of course, just throw it in the wash straight away, or you can bring it straight to the dry cleaner. And that'll just sort of quell any fears you have about the smell or anything like that. Also, case a neighborhood. You can sort of figure out by going to a few Salvation Armies or other stores what neighborhoods get the best stuff, because, of course, different neighborhoods will have different people donating to them. Sometimes they move stuff around stores, but not always. If you can, check out secondhand stores in cities like London and New York and even Hong Kong, major cities. They just blow every other city out of the water. My theory is that because they have so little living space, even rich people have to get rid of really good luxury items a lot more often than they would anywhere else. They're also buying, of course, these luxury items, and, you know, after one season, they can't be seen in them. So they get rid of them, and then everyone else reaps the benefits. Also, I actually used to volunteer at Oxfam in London. And they're a charity. People know them, but they have specific charity shops in London. They have bookstores and clothing stores. And they just do it a lot better than we do. And I think we have a lot to learn from them. They, you know, put a fresh coat of paint. They're in really metropolitan areas. They set the whole store up like a shop. Like, it feels like an actual shop. So I think people feel a lot more comfortable shopping there, even though it's secondhand, because it feels like you're in like a cute little shop instead of at like a church bazaar where everything's just a mess. So it really just makes it a lot more appealing to a wider group of people. And I guess lastly, all I'll say is, you know, if you go to a secondhand clothing store and you're getting, you know, a shirt for $8 with the money going to charity, and you get home and you don't like it, or, you know, you find a little tear, just re-donate it. You know, you can bring it back. And just consider that you've made an $8 donation to the charity. And just, you know, it's not as big a deal as buying a, you know, $100 shirt anywhere else.
So. Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it, for sure. And like you said too, I like the idea of where you were having the friend swap, and if, you know, things are left over at the end, that it gets donated to a women's shelter or to some sort of shelter that, you know, could use that. I think that's an excellent way of looking at things. So that's awesome. And a final question, even before I let you go, just back to the sort of art of cleaning out your closet, because obviously this is something that I think you have down to a science. What would you say would be your main rule of thumb when it comes to that? Because I know, for example, my mom, Mommy Alexander, has a rule in her head that goes, you know, whether it's vintage or used clothing or brand new clothing, if something goes into the closet, something comes out of the closet.
Right. I have tried to live by that rule, but I just cannot. I think it's an amazing rule and it really makes sense, but I don't know what happens. I keep breaking it. My rule would probably be if you've tried on something more than 3 times and kind of worn it around your room or been about to go out in it and changed into something else at the last minute, there's something wrong. Either you don't like how it looks on you or it's not comfortable enough. Just that's a sign that you don't want that thing.
I think that's a great thing, actually. I think because I think actually right now as you're speaking, I'm like, I have like 2 or 3 of those. So I'm glad
you brought that up.
Put
it on. Yeah.
Because, and that's part of me that's like, you know, I would really want to wear that. And then, like you said, I've worn it and then just about, you know, ready to head out the door and I'm like, nope.
Right. Yeah. And it's just, maybe it's not even something tangible or that you can put your finger on, but clearly there's something that you're just not comfortable in that outfit. My other thing, I guess, would be if you're like me and you're, you know, at your optimal size and shape and you're comfortable with how you look and you have something that is too snug on you, you're never going to go back in time. You're never going to be, you know, 20 pounds smaller, and nor would you want to be. So just get rid of it. It's that too is like some sort of psychological block. We just have to get past it
and move forward. Eve, yeah. You've been awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
No problem whatsoever.
Happy to have her on our show, our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas. And again, do not forget to check out her brand new blog, thegreatergoods.org.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, I have to tell you, I feel very fortunate right now to have a very special guest return to the Kelly Alexander Show, and it's someone who's very special in my life, and we had her on the show actually a few months ago. It's my grandma, Grandma Alexander, and we had such a positive response to her earlier visit when she talked about her illustrious career as an organist that we thought it would be excellent to have her back on the show and talk about how she grew up on a farm. And my grandma actually has been on two farms throughout her life, so she is definitely a farmer. She grew up on one farm, and then when she married my grandfather, she's been on the current homestead where she lives to this day. And so I thought it would be interesting actually to speak to my grandma about certain aspects of farm life, because it is so different from what it is today, and even suburb life that we have today, it's just so different. There are a lot of amenities and things that we have now, they didn't have readily available to them back in those times in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. A lot of things that we take for granted now, like calling up a carpenter or having air conditioning or a veterinarian, all those things were difficult to come by. So I thought it would be really cool to talk to my grandma about specific instances as she grew up and went through farm life. So the first thing we're going to sort of talk about today is actually making ice blocks. And I know that probably sounds very strange to someone who doesn't know, but obviously, you know, back in those days, they didn't have big refrigerators and big freezers. So they had to come up with a way to keep ice, to get them through the hot months and until they were, you know, sort of back into the winter months. So first of all, Grandma, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much.
So Grandma, the first thing, again, if you can just sort of explain to us why you needed ice blocks and sort of how you went about getting them and making them.
Well, we had a dairy farm, and there was milk that had to be kept cool all through the year. So naturally, in the summertime, especially, well, all the time it needed to be kept cool, but in the summertime it took quite a lot of blocks of ice to keep the 8-gallon cans of milk cool in the tank before they were shipped off to Montreal to the dairy to be distributed, the milk to customers in Montreal.
And so, Grandma, when would you have to make these ice blocks? And I suppose, what would they look like?
Well, they were very large blocks, which were very heavy to handle. And on my home farm, it had to be a team of horses that went down to the river, and the ice was cut, and it was in very huge blocks that had to be pulled out of the river and loaded on the sleigh and brought up a very steep hill to get it to the farm and store it for the year coming.
And back to sort of how the ice was cut, that sounds like a lot of work. And obviously back in those days, because I know now when people go ice fishing and stuff, a lot of them can use chainsaws and stuff to cut the ice. Obviously that wasn't an option. So how would this ice be cut, Grandma?
They had saws for that. And they used to saw it by hand. It was done by hand. And they had to make them uniform size and everything, because once they got it to the farm, that's all had to fit into what we call the ice house. And they had to be able to be put together close so that they would keep as cold as possible for the future use.
And Grandma, how many people would it take to actually cut the blocks of ice and then to sort of, I guess, pull it out of the river, because that seems like a really hard job as well, to sort of get it, you know, out of the river, this big frozen chunk of ice, and load it on a sleigh.
It was very, very heavy and cold work, because it had to be done in the coldest time of the year, because you had to get the blocks of ice when they were at their thickest. And there would be, the men would go down, and sometimes there'd be more than one farmer there. There might be another or two or three, and they would wait their turns to load up their sleighs and take these blocks home. And the worst part of it was that when they were pulling these blocks out of the water, all the lower part of their pants would be wet and frozen so stiff that when they'd come home, you could stand them up, because they'd have layers and layers of water and ice on their pants from pulling these out of the river and getting them onto the sleigh.
And Grandma, how many blocks of ice would you need? I guess it depended on the size of the farm and stuff.
That's right, because we needed a lot. We had about 50 milk cows at that time, and the milk had to be cooled as fast as possible. And yes, there were hundreds and hundreds of blocks of ice. And those blocks of ice, you had to first of all be sure that you had your supply of sawdust in, because that was the insulation that kept those blocks cold through the summer months. And you would have to be sure that they were packed as tight as possible with sawdust, and the insulation between the blocks and the sides of the ice house would be filled with sawdust also, because they had to insulate them as well as possible to keep them cold. And that's the way that they did that.
And Grandma, back to the river, I guess, for just a second. First of all, you said you needed tons and tons of blocks. Would you gather the ice blocks, you know, in sort of, you know, two different time periods, I guess, or would you do it all at once, like get these hundreds of blocks? And then the other question would be, would you always, like year after year, go to the same spot in the river to do it?
We went to the same spot in the river, as far as I know, because it was one of the deeper portions, and they were able to pull the blocks out and get a good size all the time. And what was your other question, Kelly?
The other question was, would you do it in two different times? Like, it just seems like it's such an arduous task to get all these blocks at the same time. Would you do it like one in January, one in February, or?
No, it was all done at once while there was a good cold snap going, because we didn't want any thaws or anything that would make it extra hard to maneuver the blocks of ice, you know.
And when you would put them on the sleigh, Grandma, again, this must have weighed so much, these blocks of ice. How many horses would it take to do this? And would you have to change teams, I guess? Like, would they get super tired of doing this? Like, you know, or would you need several teams of horses to get the job done?
Not really. We had two heavy teams, horses, and we used to alternate them, you know, one. But over the time, they were able to cope with it, because they were heavy horses, and they were able. The worst part of it was that we, as soon as they came up from the river, we had a terrible hill to go up, and that was really hard on horses. And I used to feel quite sorry for them, but they managed to get the loads up and get them to the farm. And then once they got them to the farm, they had to pack those ice blocks with sawdust. And the first row weren't too bad, but then we had to have a ramp because they started getting too high for us to maneuver. So they'd send them up on a ramp and build up layer after layer of ice blocks right up to the roof.
So almost like building like a pyramid, I guess, kind of.
That's right, yes. And always between the layers would be sawdust.
And Grandma, like, again, that just sounds like such an arduous task. Would it take, like, I know you said you needed to wait to do it during a cold snap. Mm-hmm. So would the job take like 2 or 3 days to get done?
Well, luckily, I would think so. I can't exactly remember. But, you know, by the time they would get the loads loaded and get them up to the farm and load them and go back down again, they couldn't make too many loads in a day. They did the best they could, but it wasn't easy because it was so time-consuming.
You know, once they did sort of bring it towards the ice house, Grandma, how do they keep the sawdust attached to the ice? Did they have to wet the ice a little bit to keep it sticky?
No, they didn't do that. It seemed to be part of the nature of it, that that it all stayed pretty well together. And then, of course, when they took the blocks out, they had to be well washed to get the sawdust off them, because you couldn't put them in the milk tank with sawdust on them. And one of the pictures I have of your father's, he was about 4 years old, and he was washing the blocks of ice here. Now, your grandfather, he got his ice blocks down at the Mille Lille River, so he had a long piece to come from Terrebonne up with those loads of ice, whereas at my home farm, we didn't have that far to go, except that we had a very bad hill, but so did he down at Terrebonne.
Was there a particular reason, Grandma? Because I know, just to give everyone a sort of, I guess, an idea of what our farm looks like currently, where my grandma lives and where my parents live, there is a river which is literally at the bottom of the hill. And so Grandma just mentioned that my grandfather chose not to go to the river, which is literally just at the bottom of the hill, but went at least, I don't even know if it's 4 miles, 5 miles away. So that's a long trip. Why did he not take the ice blocks from our river, Grandma?
I really don't know, Kelly, but it never was done that way. They always got it. I think they were better able to get a good depth of block at the Mille Lille River, because it's a much bigger river than the one that's close to us.
And when they would load these blocks, Grandma, again into the ice house, you said there were several layers as you would build the pyramid, and then that ramp that they would need to do. How are they hauling the ice blocks as the ramp, you know, as the pyramid got higher? Like, was it several men that would need to sort of shove and push to get it up to the top?
Well, you know, I can't remember that, Kelly. I just remember the ramp there, and I imagine that they used the ice tongs to get them up, because I don't know any other way that they could have done it.
And then, so Grandma, another question I would have, like you said, is you needed these ice blocks to get you from, you know, the spring when things started to warm up, you know, to the fall when things started to cool down again. How often, like how long would, I guess, a block of ice last? How many blocks of ice would you need, I guess, in a week, or how often would you change the blocks?
In the summertime, quite a lot. Because, of course, the weather was warmer, and it did take quite a few blocks to. But once they were in the vat and the top put down on them, it helped to keep the cold in there for them. And it wasn't too bad. But again, it depended on how many cans of milk were going in, because the milk that went in was just freshly taken from the cows, so it was warm.
Grandma, what else would you use the ice blocks for? Was it exclusively for the milk from the cows, or did you also need it, like, in the kitchen for your produce and stuff?
Oh, yes. We used to get our chunks of ice to put in our ice boxes, because we didn't have electricity. And these were the old-fashioned ice boxes where there was a pan underneath where the water went there, and woe betide the one that forgot to empty it.
Wow, yeah, I guess so, because you'd have water spilling all over the floor. So it was ice blocks for the milk, and then ice blocks for your ice box in the actual house, for lack of a better word, your freezer at the time. Any other uses for it, Graham, or those were the main two?
Those were the main two, as long as we kept the milk cold and our own refrigerator cold for our food. That was the main things, yeah.
Well, that's fantastic, Grandma. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I just think this is so interesting to speak to you about all these endeavors and challenges, I guess, that you and Grandpa had to go through, you know, all those years ago. And other farmers, pretty much, you know, whether you're in Canada or the U.S., I think this was a task that probably had to be done by farmers just all over the country. And it's just interesting to talk to someone who has gone through all of this and survived. So thank you, Grandma.
You're very welcome.
So we will have Grandma Alexander back on the show in the not too distant future, because there's so many more tales to tell from life on the farm. So my thanks again to Grandma Alexander right here on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Bring on the remix.
That is Jennifer Lopez with On the Floor, remixed by Second Adventure on The Kelly Alexander Show. We also had UB40 earlier on with their hit song, Red Red Wine. Well, can't believe another 60 minutes has come and gone. A big thank you to my guests this week, Tommy Powers, Eve Thomas, and the lady I love so much, my grandma, Grandma Alexander. Now, here is the big news that I've been waiting all show to let you in on. As mentioned off the top, we have a fantastic contest that we're running on the Kelly Alexander Show website starting on Easter Sunday. It's our scavenger hunt, and all the contest details are going to be on the website as of Easter weekend. Now, the scavenger hunt is very simple. All you have to do is answer all the questions correctly, and then you are in to win a gift certificate from Amazon valued at $50. Best of luck, and again, details available for you on the website this weekend, kellyalexandershow.com. And before I go this week, I want you to look forward to a very special guest on our show next week, our gardening expert, Tara Nolan from canadiangardening.com. She will be here to give us all the 411 on what you need to be doing in your garden this spring. So have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.